The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Master Dogen taught in an informal talk to open the fall practice period. Zhujing, my late master, presented this poem. Piling up bones in an open field, gouging out a cave in an empty sky. Break through the barrier of all dualities and splash in a bucket of pitch black lacquer. To grab hold of this spirit, to train constantly for 30 years, eating meals, sleeping, stretching your legs, this requires unstinting support. The structure of the 90-day training period provides such support. It's the head and face of Buddhas and ancestors. It's been intimately transmitted as their skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. You turn the Buddha ancestors' eyes and heads into the days and months of the 90-day practice period. Regard the whole of each practice period as the whole of the Buddhas and ancestors. From top to bottom, the practice period is Buddha ancestors. It covers everything, without an inch of land or speck of earth left out. The practice period is an anchoring peg that is neither new nor old, has never arrived, and will never leave. It's the size of your hand and takes the form of grabbing you by the nose. When the practice period is open, the empty sky cracks apart and all of space is dissolved. When the practice period is closed, the earth explodes, leaving no place undisturbed. Good morning. This was written in the 1200s in Japan by Master Dogen. And if you study the fascicle practice period in the Shobogenzo that this is drawn from, you'll see that what we do and we practice Sangho is very similar. Cut from the same cloth. As Gokhan was reading the names of everyone who has joined this Sangho, I was looking out the front window at that silver maple that has been such a friend over all these years and has grown so beautifully. And I was thinking about time and ancestors, thinking of Dogen doing his first practice period, his first Sesshin, sitting Zazen for the first time, of the Buddha as his community began to form over 25 centuries ago in India, and practicing and developing that community within the time and place, the seasons, the elements. They had no homes, they had nowhere to dwell. That was their rule in the beginning, no dwelling place. They could build small structures during the rainy season when they would gather to practice what we call Sangho, but they were required to dismantle them at the end of the period. Because, you know, if you've gone to all the trouble of building a shelter, you might want to keep it for the next time. And each time you come back, you add a little something to it, right? It starts to turn into a place. But soon enough, even in the Buddha's time, there were buildings and places to gather and to do the practice period and to think about what those early years must have been like and then how that tradition continued. And I was thinking about how our tradition is such a in the body and mind thing. You know, we don't just gather and hear words or have something conferred on us and then go home and kind of forget about it and just go on as usual. Within Buddhism, what we do, how we practice, how it affects our lives is the whole thing. It's the whole thing. And so we have brought ourselves here on our feet, right? Having made decisions in our mind, you at home have brought yourself here today on your feet, making your own decisions. And entering into the practice period, the training period we call Ango, peaceful dwelling, the whole 90 days is a path. It's something we engage every day. We wake up to it. We live it throughout the day, and then we go to sleep within it. To grab hold of the great spirit of the Buddhas and ancestors. As Master Dogen says, to train our bodies and minds. How? In our eating, in our sleeping, in our stretching, in our sitting, in our bowing. And he says this requires unstinting support. We need support to do this. We need this body, this Buddha body, this vehicle, this miracle that is impermanent. It's come, it will go. But now, today, we're here in this body. That's a significant part of our support. We need each other. Sangha, we need a place to practice. We need a way to practice. We need ways to know if we're practicing or not, to know when we're on the path and to know when we've wandered. This 90-day practice period, Dogen says, has been intimately transmitted. How? Through example. Those of us who have been around for a while, who are part of the teaching or training staff, how did we learn this? By doing it. Each of us came in as baby Buddhas, entered into this hall for the first time, entered in at some point to do our first Ango, and we began learning. We began acquiring that knowledge by doing it, by seeing others who had done it more, longer, who were teaching how to do it. And in that way, we embodied, just as you are today, embodied this experience. That's how it's transmitted. Teacher to student, year after year, generation after generation. And our task, as Master Dogen says, is to not leave anything out. Not an inch of land or a speck of earth, which means to understand that in this we bring in the whole universe. And also to not leave out anything essential of the Buddha Dharma, of the tradition, of the teaching. So when we make choices, how are we going to do this Ango? How are we going to do this day of entering this way, not having done this before? And so it means really turning towards what is the most important and what are the essential things that need to be happening. Both what has been done before, right? What are those liturgies, those words that are spoken, the way we enter the Zendo, all of that, how has that been done? But also, why are we doing those things? What are we trying to do when we create those liturgies? What are those words trying to express? So that if the container changes, the time changes, as it has, we can adapt and be drawing from that understanding, from the heart of the tradition, so that we retain, as we create new ways of doing this, as we have in some ways this morning, and retain the heart of it. Just as the Buddha was practicing in his time, in a time of change, great social change, Dogen was practicing in a time of great social change. They had to incorporate that, right? They were influenced by that. They had to respond to that in some way, even if they were deep in the mountains. We too are practicing within a time and a place, a context. We have words to speak about that. Politics, economies, elections, governments, societies. And at this time where so much that is true is taken to be false, and so much that is false is taken to be true. To know your mind, to bring forth your spiritual powers, your humanity, your powers of contemplation, of zazen, of attention, of awareness. These words change worlds. The words don't change worlds, but what the world's words point to do. To have developed your attention, your awareness. In doing that, we gain, we reclaim our ability to live our lives as we aspire to. Without that, we can have great aspirations, but not be able to do what we aspire to do. Wanting is not enough. The power of non-attachment, the power of loving kindness, of compassion, of generosity, these virtues, these practices change the world, as do their opposites. Peaceful dwelling doesn't mean that we are always peaceful in our hearts. It doesn't mean we're always acting peaceful, but it's our aspiration. It is what we are here to be about. Recognizing how much we as individuals want and need this and have a rightful claim to peaceful dwelling. And also recognizing how, in what great need our world is for these medicines. To see what has been hidden, to release what is stuck and held, to realize what has always been true. And to live this in our thoughts, in our words, in our actions. And I remember when in my early years, when I would hear those words, I would just think, oh my God, that's impossible. Like in every thought, in every word, in every action. That's our aspiration. Right? Because if we have a mediocre aspiration, which is more, it's like, oh, okay, I can do that. But do what? In a sense, our culture kind of grooms us to mediocrity. So yes, it is a great aspiration. As Master Dogen says, aim high while your feet touch the ground. Which is another way of saying to take seriously your life. Take it seriously. Like it matters. To take seriously the teachings, to take seriously the truth that you have Buddha nature. That's your nature. Having that nature, we are here. And being here, we have the opportunity to do something quite wonderful in our lives, to be of service, to not create more chaos, but to diminish that and bring clarity instead, to not add more greed, but to turn that around and know how to live simply, to not add more anger and fear, but bring forth compassion, to turn inward deeply without avoiding anything. That's why Dogen says, don't leave out an inch of land or a speck of earth. And to turn outward without losing ourselves, without getting lost in turning outward. The great Master Padmasambhava said, though your view should be as vast as the sky, keep your actions as fine as flour. And a master commented on this and says, don't confuse one with the other. When training in clear understanding, you can be unbiased, impartial, vast, immense, and unlimited as the sky. That's your mind. Your actions at the same time should be careful, thoughtful, aware, in knowing the difference between what is beneficial and what's harmful, what is good and what is evil. We can unify these views with our actions, but don't confuse them. Both are important. And so we practice this Sangha within this time of COVID, a pandemic of sickness, old age, and death, uncertainty, of so many people working so hard to bring the medicine to this illness, and others who are not. We begin this ongoing in a time of great racial injustice and the great demand for racial justice to not only stop the killing, but to transform hundreds and hundreds of years of harm, of created, rationalized, institutionalized violence. We live in a time of, we practice this ongoing time of climate crisis, which is struggling so hard from those who see the danger to bring it forward into our minds. It keeps getting pushed away as other things, other crises become urgent. But all of these are of one substance. All of these are of one world. All of these are of one humanity. And we're entering into this ongoing in an election season, which may be one of the most consequential in our lifetimes. And so we enter the ongoing at a time when there is abundant fear, resentment, anger, hatred, bitterness, words of blame and divisiveness, deception, deflection, whether actions of violence, obstruction, cruelty, selfishness. So the three poisons, the kleshas, all that we contain within us as human beings, all that creates suffering, is on such vivid display. And we begin with this ongo within life, within thoughts, words, and actions of patience and acceptance and tolerance and love and compassion, loving kindness, of commitment, of honesty, of integrity. Those things still matter. Those things will never not matter. When something is devalued, that doesn't mean it loses its value. It means its value is not being recognized. And in that, it becomes even more valuable. Knowing our mind means knowing what is important, what is valuable, what do I need to be drawing forth from within myself, particularly at this time. What are the qualities I need to be very clear and careful about nurturing, strengthening, living? The theme of our ongo is bodhisattva. It doesn't really get any bigger than that. And as I always say, because it's always true, is that when we start an ongo and we have a theme, it's nothing new, right? The theme is always our bread and water. We're just taking something, right? One essential part of the teachings or our practice that we're always pointing to, that we're always practicing, but now we bring it out and hold it in a particular point of emphasis. The bodhisattva, the great being, who is dedicated, devoted. Devoted is a good word. A devotion. Devotion is something from the heart that requires courage, which is also directly from the heart. This is not a cold and calculated thing. This is a matter of the greatest urgency, which means it's coming from our very depths. The bodhisattva is a being who recognizes what's important. And despite their fears, their concerns, their sense of insufficiency, not up to this task, I take it on. I step into it. Inadequate though I am, I step into it. not knowing what will come, I take it on. Wanting to affect change, but with a keen eye to not grasping at expectations. Wanting to bring forth non-attachment, and so being very alert to becoming self-righteous. Recognizing that it is of such great importance to me personally, and yet not losing my humor. You know, Hogan Sensei yesterday spoke about, in the Mondo, about his own relationship of coming into practice and being drawn to the Dharma, and how over the years, that feeling of being drawn and loving the Dharma, wanting to practice the Dharma, being hungry for the Dharma has just increased. And I was nodding all the while because that's been so much my experience. And I think that's what happens. You know, the more we practice, the more alive it becomes, the more we want to practice. The more the doors open, the more we want to enter through those doors and see what's beyond this. Feeling insufficient, wanting to see, okay, but what can I do? Not being sure if I'll ever fulfill my vows. How deeply can I fulfill them? Not knowing how clear I might be able to get in this lifetime, how clear can I be? And so this whole Anga is dedicated to the Bodhisattva, to the path, the aspiration, our vows. And we'll be using these 37 verses by Togme Zangpo, his Tibetan master, 14th century, from central Tibet. Interesting that he also, well, also I'm thinking of Master Dogen, he lost his mother when he was 3 years old, just a young child, lost his father when he was five. Was raised by an aunt, raised by an uncle. He became ordained in his late 20s. And it's said that he too had a great hunger to study the Dharma. He would study with anybody. He wasn't concerned about lineage, school, because he recognizes there's one Dharma. And so he would study with anyone, anywhere. A wonderful model. And in these 37 verses on the practice of a bodhisattva, which we'll be working our way through during the Anga, verse by verse, he begins, homage to the great compassionate one, Avalokiteshvara. You, he's speaking to Kanon, you see that all phenomena neither come nor go, and yet you still strive solely for the benefit of beings. Supreme teacher and protector, I pay homage constantly, ceaselessly, with respectful body, speech, and mind. How do I repay this debt? With my mind, with my words, with my actions, with my life. I give my life in gratitude for what you have given me. Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattvas that we'll be studying in our practice with Hojin Sensei, the teachings that have come down to us. How can my own teacher, Dada Roshi, how could I possibly repay? Zangpo tells us, by ceaselessly, respectfully using your body, speech, and mind. Why does he begin with this homage to Avalokiteshvara? Because she is a physical manifestation of all the Buddhas. Avalokiteshvara doing deep prajna paramitas, clearly saw through all the skandhas, saw through all the ways we create, identify a sense of self, thus completely relieving misfortune and pain. All phenomena neither come nor go, not born, not dying, this sense of self, this continuity, this permanent essence that we all sense we are. We sense things have, but when we examine, what do we find? No coming, no going. Dogen says it this way, the practice period is an anchoring peg. It's not old or new, it's never arrived, and it will never leave. It doesn't exist anywhere. What is Ango? We just began. We just entered. There was a formal announcement. The entering of Ango, the arrival of Ango has just begun. Can you touch it? Can you put your finger on it? Can you describe it? Is it inside of you? Is it outside of you? And it has absolutely appeared. All dharmas are forms of emptiness. And that's why Padmasambhava says, have a view as vast as the sky. This means don't hold on to anything. Nothing. You are not stuck anywhere at all. So we shouldn't deceive ourselves into acting as though we are. There is no discrimination as to what to accept and to reject. And because of that, because that doesn't exist anywhere inherently, now we can see what's skillful and what's not. We can recognize what's good and evil. When there's no line drawn separating them, they become free. And Zangpo says, and still you strive solely for the benefit of big beings. You realize everything is empty. And because of that, you care. You act. You dedicate. You devote yourself. Because there's no inherent nature. And how do we do that? With as much careful attention as flour. Barley flour, wheat flour. Do you know how fine that is? That's how attentive. That's how awake we're being challenged to be. And now pay constant homage to bow with respectful body, speech, and mind. You know, I was thinking this morning, I was remembering in the early years of training, of practicing, of being here, when so much about Buddhism was new and unfamiliar and strange to almost everybody who was encountering. You know, there were not many books, there was no internet. It was still very much an outsider kind of thing. And liturgy was a big part of that. You know, people didn't expect liturgy. You mean there's bowing? I bow to the Buddha, but the Buddha's not a god. Why do I need to bow? And Dada Roshi used to often say, we need to learn how to bow. We as Westerners, we as Americans in this country, in this very individualistic, I did it on my own. I did it by myself culture, the Lone Ranger, right? The me first society. He said, we need to learn how to bow. And so we train, eating meals, sleeping, stretching our legs. We show our gratitude. We express our appreciation. We raise bodhicitta. And I experience it that way. You know, when I see you practicing, when I see someone next to me practicing, being very sincere, very inside of what they're doing, caring about what they're doing, taking care of something, doing something they haven't been asked to do, but taking care of it because it needs to be done, it fills my heart. I feel like I've just eaten a meal, like I've just had a banquet, like I've been given something. But it wasn't being given to me. It was just being given. That sense of gratitude, it's real. And how we can express that, how we give that through the way we live our lives. Respectful means thoughtful, means based in gratitude. It means worthy of wholeness. And so to make during Ango this our practice throughout the day, to break through the barrier of dualities, What is inside ongoing, what is outside? What is practice and what is not practicing? Those walls are very, very strong, very high, very thick. You know, the idea of practicing ceaselessly will be a burden as long as we think of practice as being something apart, right? Because it's something we have to do. Being aware will seem like a chore, right? As long as we think of it as something separate from our natural mind. And so an important part of this is what we did as we entered the Zendo and what you at home did as your name was called. And if your name wasn't called because you just showed up today or you're not able to do the Ango formally, what happened in that moment, what we're being given an opportunity to happen is the establishing of an intention that we begin in this moment having carefully considered, because that's why the preparation for Ango is so important. I spoke about that earlier this weekend. That it doesn't just get sprung on you, right? There's this sense that it's coming. It's coming. The preparations you begin hearing about, you begin receiving information. All of that is not just to inform us, but at a much deeper level to help us to begin to prepare, to turn our mind towards this, and to begin to contemplate, to reflect on this period of time that we are consciously entering into. How do I want to enter into it? What is important for me to be really bringing my attention to? If we're new to practice, if you're new to practice, in a sense, the answer to that is what's being presented to you every moment, every day. So if you're in training, it is the day. It is each aspect of the day. For those who have practiced longer and have some familiarity and some confidence with this and have been developing ourselves through these areas of training, you know, it's your job to know. What are those aspects of your own practice that need attention, more careful attention? So maybe you've been as careful as pebbles. Okay, so bring it into the realm of rice grains. Okay, and then work your way down to flour. And in that way, we're learning, we're developing, it keeps developing. We're not just doing the same old thing. Don't do that. Do something different. And I don't mean, you know, do something different. You know, it's like, it's just do what you're doing. That I do what I'm doing. Again, for the first time. And so when we sit, to know that you're sitting, to bring this intention, and it's not what I want to get from it. My intention is that by the end of the Ango, I'll be enlightened. That's not an intention. The intention is, how do I want to practice such that the awakening of my Buddha mind, the opening of the great heart of compassion, which I have deep faith is my nature, can naturally arise, can naturally be discovered. That's an intention. And to make that intention large, which means it needs to include you. I remember years ago, I was at the Jisha, my daughter Roshi's attendant, and we were in the Doksan room talking. I don't remember what we were talking about. And he mentioned something about that every morning he does a service for his teacher. And I thought, oh, busted. And I thought, in his own way, and I don't know what his intention was. We were just having a casual conversation. But because he was my teacher, in a sense, no conversation with him was casual. That doesn't mean it was tense. But no conversation with him did I just discard as meaningless talk. And so when he said that, I really heard that. And I thought, one, you're doing a service every day. Oh. I can do that. And I realized this liturgy that I'm doing every day together in the Zendo, I'm doing it as a way of, it's being, what's being shown is that this is mine. This belongs to me. The liturgy, it doesn't, it's not the property of the Zendo. It is not proprietary. That we are training in those things that belong to each of us, and we're learning what those things are. How do we give voice? What are the forms that are so powerful, like a prostration? And then that he was doing a service every morning to his teacher, and I was embarrassed, right, that I had not thought of that. And I was embarrassed that, in a sense, he had to tell me that. And I thought, thank you for telling me that. And I began doing a service for him every morning. Because I needed to. I wanted to. He wasn't telling me to do that. And on goes like that. Training is like that. Just little windows open, doors open. Sometimes they open just a little bit, or they appear to be just slightly opened, so it's as though you could pass by and never feel the breeze coming through, be unaffected. Sometimes we have to just be blown down by a strong wind to realize, oh, now I hear you. And this is really the role of bodhicitta, of the mind that is raising aspiration, that is hungry. Hungry. And we can be hungry because of our suffering. We can be hungry because of our confusion and desperation. We can be hungry because we love this life. We can be hungry because we want to do better. We can be hungry because we want to break the cycles because they're so exhausting. Oh my goodness, are they tiring, right? We got agreement on that? They are exhausting. Is that what we want to be doing with our precious, vital energies? Not me. And the way we free that energy is in calm and peaceful moments to bring forth our practice strongly. And in moments that are not peaceful, when we are caught in that cycle again, to bring forth that great intention. You know, Hogan was speaking about this last night, and you know, this is not something that just belongs to Buddhism, the understanding that each person has some role, right, in how we meet our circumstances, right? Turn lemonades and lemon into lemonades. I mean, we also turn lemonade into lemons, actually, all the time. But what does that mean, right? Something that shows up on a card you buy at the pharmacy. What does it actually mean? It's perhaps the most profound teaching. If we enter into that, we will have to encounter everything Buddhism has to teach. We will have to encounter everything that exists within us. We will be challenged because it means we will be bringing ourselves honestly and openly to those challenges with the faith that this is something. There is something happening. All right, the world is on fire. There's no mistake about it. There is a rampant breeding of anger and hatred and fear, fear-mongering, hatred-mongering. People who are actively devoted to engineering it, to broadcasting it, and to bringing forth the consequences of this. You know, it's important for me to keep encountering that because I live with all of you and you. You know, my world is so much involved with people who want to be awake, who want to change the world, who want to bring about an enlightened society. And so I realize that I can be lulled into a false view that everybody wants that, that everybody in their heart is actively working on that, and that's just not true. And every person acting in some way that is actively causing harm is doing that because it makes sense to them, because in a sense their life, their conditions, inside and outside, their familial life, their group life, their experiences they've had in their lives, and the choices they have made, just as we make our own choices, have all gone into creating a world, a view, a mind, a consciousness, in which those thoughts, those words, and those actions make sense. And it's really important to appreciate this. This is the teaching of dependent arising. This is the teaching of the skandhas. This is the teaching of the 12-fold chain. The teaching of cause and effect. And what it helps us to realize, it helps us to understand that while we are each responsible for our own actions, we are acting within forces, within and without, that are so incredibly strong, stronger than we think, stronger than we know. And that we are not just solely responsible for, we are all responsible. Our society has a responsibility. Governments have a responsibility. Anyone who is having an effect has a responsibility. And the larger that effect is, the larger that responsibility is. Because we are all being influenced by that. And that helps us to see its creation, its construction. It's not who a person is. It also helps us to not be so identified with, invested in, the action becomes the person. The action is an action. It comes from a person, but it is not who we are. And that's why having that view that is as vast as the sky allows us to look at an action, at a person, to hear someone's words, to see our own, and to recognize that, yes, this is here. Maybe it's skillful, maybe it's not. And it can change. It is changing. How is it changing? And that's the sort of the studio of the Bodhisattva. That's their workspace. What we call the Buddha field. That's where we work. That place where nothing is fixed. And so we do need to understand these conditions, you know, to understand the aggregates, the skandhas. You know, it's not, you can't just put them on the table, right, and dissect them. Even when a scientist does that, right, in a laboratory with a microscope, they themselves are putting themselves in the midst of that examination. They're affecting it. And so in our own examination, we are too examining the examiner, because the Buddha realized that's the key. If we want to alleviate the suffering, if we want to understand what is being created and how do we shift. In essence, we have to examine it at every level. That's what right understanding is. And so conceptual understanding, historical understanding, the understanding of ideology, narratives, of capitalism, of institutions, these are all just large bodies made up of individual bodies. And in the same way that a sangha, in a sense, becomes something larger than any individual and therefore has a particular power, right? That's what happens when you're not just acting as an individual. Don't be just an individual. Be something larger. So too do all of any other larger body. And so as we examine, that's why in Buddhism, going back historically, the study of sciences, of natural sciences, history, it took a while for history to be sort of recognized as something that was important to actually study. That wasn't so prevalent within the Buddha's time. That's why it's so hard to get a handle on history as we go further and further back into time, because it wasn't understood in a sort of societal sense as always being important. But we need to understand that. And so that's where this not just merging, but really unity between these very profound sort of existential teachings that point to the nature of being, the nature of consciousness, mind, and studying the history of humanity, the history of our culture, the history of our country, the history of institutions, are really part and parcel of the same thing, because both give rise to the formation of the self, which means our attachments, which means our suffering. If we want to alleviate the suffering of others, we have to alleviate our own. If we want to not be causing harm towards others, we have to stop causing our own harm. So Zangpo says, the perfect Buddha's sources of well-being and happiness arise from accomplishing the genuine Dharma. And since that in turn depends on knowing how to practice, the practices of a bodhisattva shall now be explained. Since the arising of our well-being and happiness arise from our ability to practice and accomplish the true Dharma, and since that depends on our understanding of the Dharma and how to practice it, we shall now take up the study of the bodhisattva. And so that's what these 90 days are about. And so each from our own place, for those of us in residence, we'll be doing this here. For those of you at home, we'll be doing it from home and on Friday, and during the weekend we went over all the things that we'll be practicing together, offering together in terms of engaging our practice and body practice and intensive sitting during sessions in the one continuous stream, the Ango intensive, the Fasatsus, all of this. It's all this. Studying the practices of the Bodhisattva, learning how to practice, which means at the same very moment we are practicing. Establishing our intention every day, and we really should be doing that every morning when you wake up, whether you do it before you get out of bed or you do it before your altar. You do it at the beginning or end of your morning zazen. But it's just a basic practice that each day we, within the solitude of your own mind, in your own words, based in your own present understanding and your seeking mind, your aspiration, that you articulate the intention for today. Right? Don't get ahead of yourself. Today. Right? Because you're in it. It's begun. And so to begin within that awareness, that self-awareness, to bring your attention, right, and to let those words express your desire for clear seeing, your desire for compassion, to release yourself of all that binds you, to truly be a benefit. Right? And as you speak those words, you are practicing being a bodhisattva. That's what it looks like. That's what bodhisattvas do. Through their entire life. I guarantee you that the Dalai Lama does this every morning. That any genuine practitioner, no matter how accomplished, continues to establish and articulate their intention, because it continues. And it evolves. It's said that the Buddha once said, to benefit beings is to benefit me. To harm beings is to harm me. Just as a parent rejoices when someone helps their child and their heart gladdens when someone is helpful, the Buddha's heart is gladdened when someone is helpful to another being. Just as a parent is distressed when someone hurts their child, the Buddha's heart is distressed when someone hurts another being. That's the heart of the Bodhisattva, that intimate. And so let's practice this Sangho in this way. And in whatever ways we are taking it beyond, in whatever ways we are through our Beyond Fear of Differences work, which we'll be doing this afternoon, through the work that the Black Indigenous People of Color group is doing, recognizing that each of us needs, because of our identities, because of our lives, we may need different things. And that's what, in a very real sense, what each of these groups that is being offered, particularly within the Beyond Fear work, is intended to do, is offer both the challenge and the healing. The mirror and the field of abundance. And to really appreciate that as we go through the Sangho and things likely get more difficult, that what that means is that we just turn in with more and more diligence, with more intention, with more urgency to being clear about how we are living our lives and how we are bringing that forth. So, off we go. You know, the thing that I think I'm sure all of us have seen and that we discover again and again is that when we turn towards what's difficult, within the Dharma and within the Sangha, joy appears. And from the outside, that can seem unlikely, right? Improbable. But it ain't so. And there's a reason. When we experience that, we should examine that. Why? Why should joy arise when we're facing something that's painful? What's present right in that moment? Because if we look closely, we'll see. In a sense, what are the ingredients of that joy? And that's showing us what we want to be bringing forth again and again, what we need to be keeping close to. That natural response from within us is our wisdom that's communicating something. And that joy is, in a sense, a messenger saying, follow me. Come with me, there's more. And to come with me means follow this path, right, that brought you to this moment. And so it is a gift to be here together with all of you. Right? We each make this possible for each other. And so if we really practice well and just give our hearts to it, let your heart explode, we will be doing something worthy of this time, of this season, and of the effort that we will be giving. It will be worthwhile. And larger than that.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.